Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take complex sources, grab the essential nuggets of knowledge, and distill them into the understanding you need to be truly well-informed.
Today, we are undertaking a substantial and pretty complex analysis that's been requested by you, the learner. We're looking into the strategic world of Mormon apologetics.
Right, the deliberate defense of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints against its critics.
And this is really a deep dive into rhetorical strategy. When we use the term apologetics, we need to be clear, we're not talking about, you know, saying sorry.
No, not at all.
We're referencing the Greek root, apologia,
yeah.
Which literally means speaking in defense.
Yeah.
It's the act of offering reasoned arguments or written justifications for a theory or a doctrine.
And you see it everywhere. Politics, philosophy, other religions. It's not unique to Mormonism.
Not at all.
Absolutely. Okay. And our mission here is really about precision. We are not here to debate theology or attack anyone's personal beliefs. Our goal is surgical. We're analyzing the tactics, the specific rhetorical and institutional maneuvers used to persuade, to defend, and often to manage or even misdirect a critical eye.
And that distinction is just so vital because, as our sources emphasize, we're dealing with a really broad spectrum of intentions here.
Okay.
We have to recognize that not all apologists are, you know, intentionally dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
Many are devout people doing their sincere best to reconcile some very complex information with a faith they hold deeply.
But the spectrum also includes those who are engaging in a highly selective and sometimes, well, an explicitly misleading presentation of evidence.
It does.
And to be fair, critics of the church can fall into the exact same trap, right?
Yeah.
Ignoring any evidence that complicates their own anti-narrative.
Oh, absolutely. The human brain loves confirmation bias. It's not unique to one side.
But today, we are focused specifically on the systematic methods used by those defending the institution. That's mainly because these methods often carry the weight of academic credentials or institutional endorsement.
Right. And before we really dissect the tactics, a brief historical overview is probably essential because apologetics itself has evolved quite a bit.
A necessary evolution for the church's survival in the digital age, I'd imagine.
So sure. Our sources point out this rapid shift from what we might call, say, apologetics 1.0 or traditional apologetics to a newer form, neo-apologetics or 2.0.
So apologetics 1.0, that really kicked off in the early 20th century. We're talking about figures like B.H. Roberts, who was the church historian. And he was wrestling publicly with things like evolution and archaeological finds that just seemed to contradict the Book of Mormon.
Then you had the definitive figure of the mid-20th century, Hugh Nibley.
Ah, yes.
Nibley. Starting in the 1960s, he was fiercely academic, a Ph.D. from Berkeley. And he used that credential to launch these really aggressive defenses, famously defending the Book of Abraham against critics like Gerald and Sandra Tanner.
And the institutional machine just grew from there. The BYU ecosystem became the headquarters for this defense, creating organizations like FARMS.
The Foundation for Ancient Research in Mormon Studies.
Exactly. Bringing in influential names like Daniel Peterson, John Gee, and more recently, Carrie Mulestein. Their whole focus was on finding external, specific, physical proofs for the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham.
But by the late 90s, early 2000s, that model just hit a wall.
How so?
Well, the specific proofs never really materialized. And in some cases, like the papyri for the Book of Abraham, the evidence was recovered and it decisively contradicted the sacred text. So the traditional approach of defending historical literalism, it just became less and less tenable.
So enter apologetics 2.0.
Exactly. We see the shift toward neo-apologetics, championed by scholars like Spencer Fluman and Terrell Givens. And this approach is much more sophisticated.
It moves away from finding literal proof, right?
Largely, yes. It moves toward framing the narratives using concepts that kind of blur the line between human effort and divine input.
They introduced terms like, what was it, revelation, bricolage?
Or suggesting Joseph Smith was an inspired syncretist. That last term is crucial. It's a way of saying that Joseph Smith was a spiritual genius who absorbed ideas from his contemporary environment.
Like folk magic, apocryphal stories, 19th century thought.
All of it. And then through divine inspiration, he integrated it and sort of spit it back out as scripture.
Which, okay, that attempts to protect Joseph Smith from being called a fraud, but it completely sacrifices the idea of a literal word-for-word translation.
That's the trade-off. It's a fascinating philosophical shift, but today we're really focused on the individual rhetorical tactics, the ones that often trip up the sincere truth seeker. Our goal is to analyze why these methods so often fail the test of intellectual consistency.
Okay, let's unpack this core conflict, because it really does set the stage for every tactic we're going to discuss. The sources define the fundamental tension as the use of academic credentials to push a predetermined theological mindset.
This is the most critical structural flaw in institutional apologetics. I mean, true scholarship, whether it's history, archaeology, chemistry, whatever, it has to operate on an open methodology.
You look at the evidence, and the evidence dictates the conclusion.
Right. Regardless of how inconvenient that conclusion is.
But apologetics, that's not how it works.
Not at all. It begins with an inviolable conclusion. The church is true, the Book of Mormon is ancient scripture, and then the entire academic exercise is just dedicated to forcing the evidence to comply with that given truth.
And we have a perfect self-admitted case study that illustrates this perfectly.
We do. The admission of Kerryah Muhlenstein, an Egyptologist employed by the church and a very prominent figure in the Fair Mormon community. He was speaking to a sympathetic audience, and his candor here is, well, it's devastatingly illustrative.
He admitted explicitly that his approach to studying controversial material like the Book of Abraham starts with the foundational assumption that the restored gospel, the scriptures, the claims, is true.
And this is the key quote. He says, "Therefore, any evidence I find is forced to fit into that paradigm. I don't feel that I need to defend that paradigm, only to understand the evidence that I find within that paradigm, because to me, it's a given that it's true."
Wait, let's just pause right there. That is a stunning admission.
It is.
He is essentially saying, I am trained in a secular discipline, but the moment I apply it to Mormon scripture, I shed the discipline's core requirement.
Yes. He's choosing the theological conclusion over the intellectual requirement of his PhD.
It's the absolute antithesis of academic integrity.
The minute you declare the conclusion untouchable a given, you're no longer acting as a disinterested scholar. You're not engaging in critical inquiry. You are acting as an advocate.
It's exactly the critique Dort Ehrman, the New Testament scholar, leveled at Christian apologetics. He said they're doing theology claiming to do history.
They're masquerading. That's a perfect word for it.
That raises a good question, though. Isn't it fair to say all scholars, even secular ones, come with inherent biases? How is Muhlenstein's assumption any different from, say, an atheist historian who starts with the assumption that all religious texts are human constructs?
That's a highly relevant question, and the difference really lies in the methodology and the accountability.
Okay.
An atheist historian's methodology must still allow for an outcome that refutes their assumption. For example, a discovery that fundamentally challenges materialism. Muhlenstein, however, explicitly states his methodology cannot lead to a conclusion that the Book of Abraham is fraudulent.
Regardless of the evidence from the Pyrrhic.
Regardless of anything.
Yeah.
His career, his livelihood, his faith commitment. They are all barriers to intellectual freedom.
And that brings us to the elephant in the room, the conflict of interest.
Hmm.
Many of these figures are BYU professors, researchers tied to the church, paid employees. Their salaries, benefits, retirement, it's all inextricably linked to the institution they're defending.
They are financially locked in.
That institutional bias, as one of our sources suggested, should be a required disclosure.
Absolutely. We require pharmaceutical companies to declare funding when they publish drug studies. It's the same principle.
But Muhlenstein is only this candid to the Fair Mormon audience, the people who are already in on the tradecraft. They understand the premise.
But when he or others write for the general church audience, the millions of members reading the Ensign or the Liahona or church history books, they omit this crucial foundational bias.
Right. They present their work as objective Egyptology, giving the impression that their academic credentials support the truth claim.
Exactly. They leverage the authority of the PhD while completely abandoning the methodology of the PhD.
If he were to start every article by saying, I am speaking to you now, not as an objective Egyptologist, but as a paid defender of the faith who has presupposed the conclusion, the whole game would be up.
The audience would immediately understand the context. It would be advocacy, not scholarship.
And the reason that declaration is omitted is because the intellectual weight of the argument would just instantly crumble. It would force members to ask, why can't this claim be discussed by someone without that inherent conflict of interest?
And the only answer you can come to is that the claims don't survive true disinterested academic scrutiny. This deliberate disconnect is, well, it's the foundation for all the other tactics.
So if that core flaw, starting with the answer, is the foundation, how do apologists handle historical data that just openly contradicts their answer?
Right.
Let's move to section two and analyze this tactic of temporal displacement, which is often summarized by the phrase, the past is a foreign country.
This is a classic deflection mechanism. It's designed to shut down critique very, very quickly. It's primarily deployed when dealing with truly troubling historical issues.
So things like Joseph Smith's practice of polygamy, especially with minors.
Yes, or the 130-year ban on people of black skin from the priesthood and temple, or the early church's involvement with folk magic, like using seer stones for treasure hunting.
The argument is that we, the modern listeners, suffer from presentism, that we're judging the 1800s through the moral lens of today.
Exactly. Apologists insist you have to view historical figures within their own context and culture, and our sources even point to institutional examples of this.
Like the church historian Matthew Groh.
Yeah, he cautioned youth not to be ugly tourists when viewing historical problems. He encouraged humility and charity toward people who lived in a different time.
Okay, that sounds charitable on the surface. It sounds like good historical practice. But how do we know if apologists are misusing this concept to just sidestep a real defense?
We look at the source and we look at the data. The quote, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there," comes from L.P. Hartley's 1953 novel, The Go-Between.
And what's the context there?
It refers to a character judging his own youthful terrible actions, acknowledging that his past self operated with past knowledge. It's an exercise in self-critique, recognizing moral growth.
So it's about realizing your past self made errors based on limited understanding. It's not an academic mandate against all historical moral critique.
Precisely. They're misappropriating a piece of literary wisdom and turning it into an academic rule to avoid painful truths.
And the misuse becomes clear when you look at the consistency or lack of it in how they apply it.
That's the key. They use the foreign country line specifically and exclusively when they can't mount a successful defense. If the history was defensible, they wouldn't need to throw up a philosophical smokescreen and run.
The polygamy example is probably the most damning illustration of this. Apologists often claim that Joseph Smith marrying multiple wives, including young teenagers, we have records of him marrying a 14-year-old, was acceptable or at least common for the 1840s frontier culture.
But the data just decisively refutes this. Historical research shows that in the 1840s United States, the average marriage age was around 25 and a half for women and 26 and a half for men.
And Joseph Smith was 38 when he married the 14-year-old Helen Mar Kimball.
That massive age gap was not normal. It was not acceptable, and it was not common.
And beyond that, polygamy was illegal. The state of Illinois, where Nauvoo was, banned it. So the critical piece of evidence against the foreign country defense is that Joseph Smith went to extraordinary lengths to keep his plural marriages secret.
Exactly. He denied them publicly to the community, even to his first wife, Emma. If the practice were truly normal and accepted for the time, as the apologist claims, it wouldn't have required closed-door ceremonies, threats of eternal damnation to ensure secrecy, and continuous public denial.
The secrecy itself proves the practice was seen as ethically and legally unacceptable by society at that time.
It does. And beyond the historical context, there's a fundamental theological inconsistency that this tactic creates within Mormonism itself.
Which is?
Well, Orthodox doctrine insists that God's laws are eternal. The same yesterday, today, and forever.
So it creates an immediate paradox.
Yes. If God is unchanging and his laws are eternal, how can the moral status of a doctrine like who can hold the priesthood or when it's okay to practice plural marriage be relativistic based on the century?
You can't claim a moral law from an eternal God is only valid in the 1840s but suddenly unacceptable in the 2000s. Unless you admit the law wasn't from God, but from the flawed cultural biases of man.
Exactly. The tactical utility of the past as a foreign country is clear. It is a surrender, masquerading as nuanced historical perspective. It's deployed when a defense is impossible. Hmm. It's the rhetorical equivalent of saying, we can't defend this, so let's just agree not to judge it.
That brings us logically to section 3. When the history becomes indefensible, the next tactic is to just change the definition of the words used to describe that history. Mm-hmm. We're talking about redefining core language and the slipperiest maneuver of all, manipulating historical footnotes, which critics often call lying for the Lord.
This is a linguistic shell game played with theological stakes. Apologists retrofit definitions to solve modern doctrinal or historical problems that have been exposed by critics.
Okay, let's start with the word translation. Originally, Joseph Smith used this term repeatedly when describing his work on the Book of Mormon and later the Book of Abraham. It implied a literal divine transfer of language.
Right, often mediated by a supernatural instrument like a seer stone or the Urim and Thummim.
But once the Book of Abraham papyri were recovered, translated by professional Egyptologists, and decisively debunked as common funerary texts that had zero resemblance to Joseph Smith's published book.
The word translation had to be redefined dramatically to manage the crisis.
It shifted from a literal transfer to definitions like revelation or bricolage, which means creating something new from whatever is available, or, as we discussed, co-authorship.
The problem there is consistency. Apologists often retroactively apply instructions given to Oliver Cowdery in the Doctrine and Covenants to justify this new, loose definition. Specifically, the instruction to Cowdery, after he failed to translate, was to study it out in your mind.
And that was used by Joseph Smith to explain Oliver's failure. He was basically telling Oliver that revelation requires intellectual work.
Right. And apologists now use that line to conflate the Book of Mormon translation, which Joseph often claimed was a miraculous word-for-word process, with the Book of Abraham, where there was clearly a massive historical failure. They're essentially excusing all the gaps and errors as part of the study it out in your mind process.
So they're retrofitting a 19th century failure explanation into a 21st century doctrinal defense.
Even though the methods described for the two books were historically contradictory.
The other major linguistic manipulation involves the word skin, specifically about the doctrine that dark skin was a physical curse from God placed upon the Lamanites.
Right, to distinguish them from the righteous Nephites. This doctrine was codified in the scriptures and reinforced for over a century. The evidence for its literal application is overwhelming.
You don't have to look any further than the controversy around the 2020 Come Follow Me manual.
Oh, that's a perfect example of institutional adaptation in real time. The initial print edition of that manual explicitly stated that the dark skin was placed on the Lamanites so that they could be distinguished from the Nephites, and that the dark skin was the sign of the curse.
But once that clear, literal interpretation hit the public and created a massive controversy in a modern social environment,
the digital edition was quietly changed to remove those statements.
Mm-hmm.
And concurrently, apologists aggressively redefined skin to mean a spiritual mark or a countenance or a state of disfavor rather than literal skin color.
But that attempt to spiritualize the curse just ignores decades of the church's own published materials, including the pictures in Children's Book of Mormon stories, which always showed dark-skinned Lamanites.
They're asking members to ignore the plainest reading of the text and the entire historical context.
And here's the layer of just profound irony. Daniel C. Peterson, a huge figure in Mormon apologetics, wrote a book titled Offenders for a Word, accusing critics of playing word games.
Well, his own camp is simultaneously arguing that the word skin used in scripture doesn't actually mean skin.
It just demonstrates the tactic. When the plain reading becomes ethically untenable, you change the dictionary rather than changing the claim.
Exactly.
Now let's dive into the most ethically problematic move, following the footnotes. This is where context omission becomes a strategic weapon.
Yeah. What critics term lying for the Lord.
Mm.
We can look at two specific institutional examples from the official church-published Gospel Topics essays, which were created to address these very issues.
Okay, where's the first one?
It's in the Book of Abraham essay. To support the idea that Joseph Smith translated by inspiration, even if the papyri didn't match, the essay needed a positive witness.
So they cited a quote from Warren Parrish, Joseph Smith's former secretary. The quote the essay uses is that Parrish saw Joseph translating by direct inspiration of heaven.
Right. They present this as a corroborating witness to the legitimacy of the whole process.
But what's the missing context?
The critical omission is that Warren Parrish did not leave the church quietly. He left specifically and publicly over Joseph Smith's improper financial dealings, especially the collapse of the Kirtland Safety Society Bank.
So Parrish is actually an antagonist, a bitter one.
A very bitter former insider. And the very letter that the church essay quotes that one positive single line from, it's sandwiched between paragraphs where Parrish explicitly details how Joseph Smith and Cindy Rigdon's lives were one continued scene of lying, deception, and fraud.
That is next-level manipulation.
It is.
They're taking a tiny sliver of text cut from its highly critical context from an author who is condemning the prophet for fraud, and they use that sliver to suggest the author actually corroborates the prophet's divine gifts.
And if you don't follow that footnote, you are completely misled about the source's reliability.
Well, that's the second example.
It's equally troubling. It's from the Race and the Priesthood essay, footnote 9. This essay tries to explain the ban on people of black skin from the priesthood. To suggest the ban was always meant to be temporary, the essay cites Brigham Young.
And what's the quote they use?
Is Brigham Young saying that at some future day, black members would have all the privileges and more enjoyed by other members.
That sounds like he was signaling the ban would lift. It suggests a temporary measure.
It does. But when you look up the full quote, which the essay conveniently omits, Brigham Young tied the lifting of the ban to a completely indefinite cosmic timeline. He stated the ban would not lift until the last of the posterity of Abel had received the priesthood and until the redemption of the earth.
That's a goalpost moved infinitely far away.
Infinitely. The full context shows Brigham Young was placing the event so far into the future that it was effectively unattainable. It completely undermines the soon or temporary implication the essay suggests.
So they deliberately clip the positive-sounding ending while omitting the horrifying, indefinite conditions that precede it.
It's theological advocacy, designed to give the impression of nuance while hiding the critical, inconvenient context.
Let's pivot now to section 4, manufacturing proof. This centers on the central apologetic trick known as the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, which is often employed under the guise of, how could Joseph Smith have known?
The Texas sharpshooter fallacy is a fantastic analogy here. Imagine someone shooting 20 arrows randomly into the side of a huge barn.
Okay.
After all the arrows are stuck, they walk up to the barn and draw a target around the single successful cluster of shots. Mm-hmm. They just ignore the vast number of misses.
And that's exactly what happens in scriptural apologetics. Apologists ignore the high probability of common guesses and the vast number of proven anachronisms in the Book of Mormon: steel, cement, horses, in favor of focusing on one obscure point that seems to align with ancient findings.
And the counter evidence to the question, how could Joseph have known, is often just readily available from his contemporary environment. His knowledge didn't usually come from divine omniscience.
It often came from accessible, widely circulated contemporary sources.
That's it.
Give us an example of a supposed hit that was actually sourced locally.
Okay, one of the strongest alleged hits in the Book of Abraham is the mention of Abraham being attempted to be sacrificed on an altar. Apologists use this to argue Joseph had unique ancient information.
Right.
But Joseph Smith was extensively involved in revising the Bible, and he had access to popular theological texts of the day, specifically the Adam Clark commentary on the Bible.
And what did the Adam Clark commentary say?
It contained a discussion, widely available at the time, that mentioned the apocryphal traditions surrounding Abraham's sacrifice attempt. Plus, he had access to other apocryphal works that circulated similar stories.
So the question, how could Joseph have known, is usually answered by, because he was a voracious reader who absorbed it from a widely available source.
That's usually the answer. And this tactical focus on obscure parallels leads directly into the concept of parallelomania.
Parallelomania.
It's the practice of finding these really flimsy parallels between ancient cultures and Mormon texts to prove an ancient origin. It's always driven by motivated reasoning, forcing a correlation to equal causation.
The famous example is Nahum. Apologists found an altar in Yemen with the letters NHM on it and claimed this corresponded to the Book of Mormon's place name, Nahum.
But this requires ignoring huge problems.
Mm.
The location, the lack of context, the fact that you're forcing a modern name onto ancient, vowel-less Hebrew consonants found on a burial altar, not a city marker.
It's imposing the parallel onto the evidence.
Right, rather than letting the evidence speak for itself.
Or what about the search for gold plates? Apologists will point to obscure examples like the Pearson tablets, which are these small token metal artifacts from burial rituals.
But these artifacts ignore the massive difference in scale and complexity, claiming small token plates prove the existence of massive inscribed gold records is stretching a parallel beyond its breaking point.
We also discuss the human sacrifice claims in the Book of Abraham.
And this is where we return to the Mulestein problem. As world-leading Egyptologists like Dr. Robert Rittner pointed out, apologists often conflate standard capital punishment for crimes, judicial executions, with ritual sacrifice.
They associate these judicial killings with religious sacrifice to make a weak textual parallel seem strong.
They're trying to find proof for a prophet who claims to have translated a text by forcing external evidence to conform to that text.
And this whole method of manufacturing proof through selective parallels, this was pioneered by Hugh Nibley.
It was. And his methodology eventually came under fire even from his own BYU colleagues.
Really?
Yes. Kent P. Jackson, a prominent BYU professor, offered a stunning critique. He stated that Nibley would gather material from diverse ancient cultures, cultures that were geographically separate, ideologically exclusive.
And then what?
Then he would lump them all together and pick and choose whatever fit his presuppositions.
And the result of that?
Nibley manufactured an artificial synthesis that never really existed. He took evidence from mutually exclusive belief systems and created this unified ancient backdrop that just so happened to look exactly like Normanism.
That's the definition of parallelomania.
It is.
And finally, the ultimate example often trotted out as proof is chiasmus, this poetic structure where phrases are mirrored.
A, B, C, then C prime, B prime, A prime.
And it's claimed this structure is definitive proof of the Book of Mormon's ancient Hebrew origin.
But the problem is, it's a common rhetorical structure found extensively in the Bible, which Joseph Smith read constantly. It was part of the language environment he was swimming in.
And as critics love to point out, because it's just a literary device, it's easily identified or, more importantly, easily faked.
It's been found in everything from nursery rhymes to the works of Dr. Seuss.
So if a structural element is so common that it appears in children's books, it cannot logically serve as unique proof of ancient origin.
It's just confirmation bias dressed up as forensic linguistics.
Now we move to section 5, which explores the institutional framework that necessitates and encourages these defensive maneuvers, institutional deception, and the suppression of history.
Mm-hmm.
This brings us back squarely to the concept of prioritizing faith over truth, or as some call it, lying for the Lord.
And apologists aren't just individual agents operating in isolation. They're carrying out institutional policy. We have direct evidence of this in the warnings given by the highest leaders of the church to their own educational staff.
Specifically the church educational system, or CES, instructors.
Exactly. The most direct directive came from Boyd K. Packer, who was an apostle at the time. He gave this chilling warning that if church history is not properly written or properly taught, it may be a faith destroyer.
Wow. That's a remarkable statement because it redefines the entire purpose of history. The goal isn't accuracy, it's faith preservation.
He then escalated the warning, targeting professional historians and educators. He stated explicitly that those who choose to follow the tenets of their profession, meaning those who pursue objective, unvarnished truth over protecting the faith of those not ready,
are in spiritual jeopardy and have broken his covenants.
The message could not be clearer. Professional integrity is secondary to institutional loyalty. If the facts undermine belief, the facts must be obscured or withheld.
That's a direct institutional directive to deceive by omission.
It is. And Elder Russell Ballard echoed this sentiment in 2016, also addressing CES instructors, specifically targeting the digital age.
Ballard told them they must aggressively help students discern between reliable information, which he defined as LDS scholarship and prophets, and half-truths, meaning stuff you find on the internet.
And then he delivered the quote that became instantly infamous among critics. James did not say, if you had lack wisdom, let him Google.
That quote just perfectly encapsulates the church's policy of controlling the narrative.
You are instructed to confine your search for truth only to approved in-house sources. Any attempt to verify claims using external, non-approved historical or academic methods is explicitly branded as seeking half-truths.
It fundamentally kneecaps critical evaluation.
It does. And we see institutional accountability demonstrated through the act of suppression and hiding of history across decades. A key example involves the First Vision accounts.
In 1944, Joseph Fielding Smith, a future church president, famously removed the 1832 First Vision account from Joseph Smith's personal journal.
And this was the earliest and critically the most problematic one.
Why was the 1832 account so problematic?
It differs significantly from the later canonized 1838 version. The 1832 account focuses heavily on Joseph Smith's concern over his own sins rather than the corruption of the external world. And crucial,
it only mentions one heavenly messenger.
Right, whereas the 1838 version, the official narrative, features two distinct personages, God the Father and Jesus Christ. This internal contradiction was just too inconvenient for the unified narrative and was hidden for decades.
And when historians and truth tellers eventually expose these inconvenient truths, the church's response is often to silence and discredit them. We saw this with the excommunications of the September 6 in 1993.
The September 6 were a group of historians, intellectuals, and feminists, people like Grant Palmer, whose work involved publishing critical analyses of controversial documents or discussing difficult aspects of early plural marriage.
And they weren't excommunicated for being inaccurate?
No, they were excommunicated for what the church termed apostasy, or undermining the faith. And that's the tactical genius of the move. The excommunications function as a form of institutional ad hominem attack.
Instead of refuting the work, you destroy the reputation of the worker.
Exactly. This ensures the general membership dismisses the information not as fact, but as material from apostate sources, effectively inoculating the faithful against the truth.
And there's one significant structural shift that more than any speech just speaks volumes about the church's priorities.
Which,
since 1982, the church has consistently chosen lawyers, not professional, academically trained historians, to serve as the official church historian.
That is a massive signal. The highest historical office in the church is clearly not prioritized for objective academic discovery. It's prioritized for legal defense, narrative control, and ultimately managing liability.
The official keeper of the history is seen as a protector of the institution's public image.
Right, reinforcing the apologetic mindset at the very highest levels. Ultimately, as historian John Hamer suggests, apologetics functions as a form of gaslighting. By forcing you to stare at tiny selective patterns in the bark of a tree through a microscope, the NHM altar, chiasmus.
They are trying to convince you that the factual narrative you encountered, the vast forest of conflicting historical evidence, is wrong, and the new institutionally approved narrative, the spin, is correct.
Exactly.
We've established the tactics and the institutional framework. Now let's look at Section 6, the unintended consequence. Apologetics is designed to preserve faith, but paradoxically, it often accelerates the faith crisis.
Yes, the most immediate boomerang effect comes from the attempt to excuse past leaders using the prophet versus man tactic.
Right. To excuse egregious actions, Joseph Smith's grooming, Brigham Young's virulent racism, and the Adam God doctrine, they say he was only speaking as a man, not as a prophet.
But if you use that shield to protect the past, you inevitably undermine the entire premise of current prophetic guidance.
Of course. If the prophet in the 1840s was just speaking as a man when he instituted eternal doctrines like plural marriage, how can we possibly trust that the current prophet is speaking as a prophet?
The line gets irrevocably blurred, and this tactical defense is contradicted by the simultaneous declarations of modern church leaders. You have figures like Sherry Dew stating just recently that the words of living prophets always have power.
You can't have it both ways.
You can't. Either every word from the podium is divine, meaning the past terrible doctrines were also divine and eternally binding, which creates huge ethical problems.
Or they frequently speak as fallible men, meaning the current prophetic voice is also inherently suspect and can't demand universal obedience.
And the apologetic ecosystem often ends up stacking mutually contradictory claims. Fair Mormon might criticize critics for using contradictory arguments, yet the apologists do the exact same thing.
How so?
Solving one problem in one area, say, explaining the lack of DNA evidence for the Book of Mormon by suggesting the Lamanite group was tiny and quickly subsumed, immediately creates an irreconcilable problem in another area.
Such as the massive populations and sprawling civilizations described in the Book of Mormon text. A tiny group couldn't achieve that.
Right. The fix for the DNA problem creates a huge textual and archaeological problem. It becomes this endless game of rack-a-mole where the defensive positions are internally inconsistent, built not on reality, but on just maintaining plausibility.
And this is why, as our sources note, the best critics often started as apologists.
That is a fascinating insight.
Why do the deep defenders become the loudest critics?
Because they were the ones who dove the deepest into the primary sources. They were trying desperately, often for years, to make the apologetic claims, the Neuholm, the chiasmus, the Muhlenstein framework work.
And they hit a wall.
They hit a wall where the spin was no longer sustainable, where the internal contradictions became too numerous to ignore. They didn't stop seeking truth. They realized the truth was outside the defined paradigm.
Which brings us back to the Bart Ehrman critique. Apologists are not objective. They are advancing religious arguments designed to confirm biases, not to discover truth.
The whole system is designed to provide serenity now, a temporary comfort blanket that confirms a member's existing faith. But for the serious truth seeker, the minute they look beyond the surface, the easily debunked nature of the arguments leads directly to insanity later.
It accelerates their disaffection because they feel they were misled by trusted authorities.
Exactly.
If the church's central claims were truly the plain and precious truths they're claimed to be, they wouldn't require vast institutionally funded organizations and constant twisting of language to make them plausible. Their strength should speak for itself.
You would think so.
Okay, let's bring this all together. We undertook a deep dive into the strategic tactics used in Mormon apologetics. Let's just recap the main maneuvers we've analyzed.
We identified the fundamental structural dishonesty of starting with the conclusion, exemplified by Kerry Muhlenstein's admission that he forces evidence into his theological paradigm.
Right, effectively undermining his own academic credentials. Then we analyzed the temporal displacement tactic. The past is a foreign country. noting its misuse to sidestep critique of things like polygamy.
Which contemporary data proves were not normal, creating a huge conflict with the idea of an unchanging God.
We covered the linguistic shell game redefining core language, seeing how translation was changed into bricolage and skin became a spiritual mark.
Linguistic maneuvers designed to make offensive or debunked doctrines palatable for a modern audience.
We detailed the ethical issue of context omission, the lying for the Lord tactic, where official church essays use fractional quotes from sources that, in their full context, actually condemn the prophet.
And finally, we discuss manufacturing proof, using the Texas sharpshooter fallacy to cherry-pick perceived hits under the guise of how could Joseph have known, while ignoring the vast array of available contemporary sources.
So the ethical conclusion remains that the core issue is the systematic use of academic authority to achieve a non-academic theological goal, often omitting context that prevents the listener from making an informed decision.
It's a form of institutional dishonesty, regardless of the faith behind it.
And here is the final provocative thought we want to leave you with. The continuous need for apologetics in Mormonism suggests a deep structural fragility.
Does a church led by individuals who claim to speak directly to the creator of the universe, who hold the keys to all truth, actually need these external defenses, often based on flawed, evolving, and sometimes misleading arguments devised by men?
If the prophetic voice is truly divine and sufficient, it should be internally consistent, clear, and require no lawyerly spin. The continuous reliance on academics and lawyers to redefine claims suggests that the institution is, at best, highly fallible.
And perhaps actively obscures inconvenient truth. That is the question you are equipped to ponder now that you understand the tactics. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
We hope this analysis has equipped you with a better understanding of the methods used to persuade and why these arguments often fall short of the demands of intellectual honesty. We will catch you next time.